We've been to all four corners of Britain in our quest to interview the great and good of entertainment. Comics, actors, writers, politicians, singers, dancers and choreographers. It doesn't matter who they are. They've all given me their own take on the world they live in and have, in their own way, helped to define what makes Britain great. So join me and my assistants as we get another insight into the marvellous and enigmatic world of showbiz here on Beyond the Title.
One of the most accomplished and influential figures in the history of light entertainment, writer, director, playwright and charity campaigner Richard Curtis began his career in 1979, penning material for the iconic BBC Two sketch show Not the 9 o'clock News, which united the comic talents of Rowan Atkinson, Pamela Stevenson, Griff Rhys-Jones and the late Mel Smith for what became a cult classic. In 1983, Richard wrote and created Britain's first time-travelling sitcom, which gave birth to one of the genre's most defining characters in Edmund Blackadder. Yet just 2 years later, in response to Michael Burke's hard-hitting news story from Ethiopia, Richard created what has become the globally recognised charity Comic Relief, which has raised over £1 billion for worldwide causes. His writing credentials kept coming, and in 1994, he teamed up with Paul Mayhew Archer to take a satirical glance at the Catholic Church's breakthrough bill to ordain female vicars, which resulted in The Vicar of Dibley. Writing the screenplays for both Four Weddings and a Funeral and Notting Hill, Curtis has become responsible for the renaissance of British romantic comedy and has been instrumental to some of the highest grossing movies in the 21st century, from the multi-award winning Bridget Jones's Diary to Bean and the 2019 musical philosophical romantic drama Yesterday, based on the music of the Beatles. I caught up with one of the most prominent figures in the history of British television to talk comedy, charity and his recollections on an unparalleled career in the arts. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Richard Curtis.
I'm fascinated by the period of the late 70s, which coincided with the commissioning of a BBC Two sketch show, which was the start of a revolution. There's people who say that Python was the start of a new era of comedy, but I tend to disagree. What do you think it was about Not the 9 o'clock News, which spearheaded a revolution in comedy?
Well, you know, it's funny you mention Python, because I think that often the rhythm of sort of comedy, even art, is that one thing is a reaction to what came before. So I think the reason why Not the 9 o'clock News was so sort of realistic, using news footage, doing very close parody of things and everything like that, is because everyone was so scared of Python, with its kind of amazing, surreal attitude to everything. And then I think if you actually sort of go forward, then you suddenly find yourself with the Mighty Boosh and things like that, which is a reaction to all the realism stuff, you know, and it tends to go in waves. So I think that what Not the 9 o'clock News was trying to be as kind of modern as it could be, you know, and very aware of two things, really: the Python surreality and then the kind of absolutely established sketch framework of the two Ronnies. You know, we were sort of the anti-two Ronnies. So I think what we did was we looked at modern culture, we looked at the news, we looked at things that people were really laughing about, rather than things like, you know, trade unions or British Rail sandwiches or stuff which we'd been told were funny but didn't actually find funny. So I think maybe it was just one of the first things to refer to life as it was coming at you at the time.
So Not the 9 o'clock News, as you mentioned, was the first show to satirize contemporary television of the day, which then moved forward into Smith and Jones' pastiche of two Ronnies. How did this create a natural division between alternative comedy and the mainstream?
Well, I mean, funnily enough, the real alternative comedy moment probably came with The Young Ones, you know, which was more anarchic and chaotic. And I think in a way we were the sort of bridge that made people comfortable there, that said the younger generation doing things in new kinds of ways can be funny. And that freed the BBC up to allow something like, you know, the young ones to get, you know, through the net or under the wire or something like that. But I do think that, you know, it was made, not the 9 o'clock news, sort of ruthlessly by young people. You know, both the producers had made TV before. All of the people were new to TV. So I think it is one of those great things where instead of saying, well, let's get the old teams back together and cast a few slightly younger people, they actually gave the whole show over to a group of young people without much sort of invigilation or interference.
I will
Josh said he read an article with Ronnie Barker that said that they were a little bit offended by one of the sketches about the two Ronnies. Was there any correspondence? Did you hear about that?
No, I mean, I was aware there was a bit of tension. There used to be this ridiculous party, a Christmas party in some soulless room at the BBC. And I remember us rocking up to that in 1980 or 1981. And there being a slight feeling of one bunch of people, the Ronnies at one side of the room and us at the other. And a conversation where Ronnie Barker was talking to Ben Elton and I think Rowan. And he just said, I like you, I don't like you. So I think they were, you know, and quite right too, if you're doing the same job but someone's being rude about you. But that tension was happening all the time in that five-year period, you know, with a lot of people being rude about the older male comedians and everything. So I think, yeah, the people, the older generation weren't entirely quiet about us.
Very rarely do you find a writer and performer who have a symbiotic understanding of each other's work. An accomplished writer himself, who you even collaborated with on several occasions, but what was it about Rowan Atkinson which made him appealing to write for?
Wow. I mean, look, when I first saw Rowan, which was kind of in a room doing a little sketch when we were planning for a sketch show. And then the first time he performed on stage at Oxford, it was obvious that he was a genius. I don't know that I've ever seen anyone who was so ahead of the game. So the great thing about Rowan is that if you produce something traditional, and we sometimes did, you know, a kind of traditional old man monologue and stuff like that, he would do it in an amazing new way. So I could write quite ordinary stuff and he'd make it new. But then the second thing with Rowan was this amazing visual stuff, which eventually turned into Mr. Bean. And I think the cool thing there was because we were friends, because as it were, he wasn't testing me out because I didn't have to submit stuff to him. We could be in a room and develop all those early visual jokes together. So I think it was, you know, it was something based on his genius and us actually being friends. And therefore, you know, because what I've always said about comedy is in some ways, all you're trying to be is almost as funny as you and your friends are at 10 o'clock at night, two beers down. And, you know, Rowan and I had the advantage of being those friends.
Obviously, the Comedy Store had a dominant influence on the future stars of alternative comedy. What was your relationship with Don and the club, And what was it about the late 70s which compelled audiences to want something different?
Well, look, I mean, the strange thing is I'm a kind of transitional figure in a weird way because, you know, there was the Footlights and we felt they were staid. And then when Rowan and I started doing a slightly different kind of comedy up in Edinburgh, we felt we were being radical. But then this group, particularly from Manchester, you know, Rick Mayall, Aid Edmondson, Ben Elton came up and they performed in, you know, an old strip club in Soho. And that was a really radical new kind of comedy. And then I think that, you know, my position was sort of being useful to them in transition to mainstream. So I suppose mainly through writing Blackadder with Ben, which showed that somebody who'd produced something as mad as The Young Ones could also produce a much more sort of traditional comedy in a way. And then, of course, eventually I did the Vicar of Dibley with Dawn, and I did, you know, Comic Relief with Lenny. So I think what's interesting is often when people start, they're very radical because that's the thing that attracts attention, but they're actually, in fact, just really good comedy creators. So there was an interesting interweaving there of the really anarchic side with a more traditional person like me, which I think I probably was.
In 1983, you took sitcom to uncharted territories when you wrote and created the Blackadder. Despite cameos from the great Peter Cook, the series was somewhat underwhelming with both audiences and critics and almost didn't get recommissioned. Looking back on your experience of television, what were the vital issues with the series?
Well, look, here's a funny one. You know what I just said about not the 9 o'clock news being a reaction to Python? The reason we wrote Blackadder was because we were frightened off by Fawlty Towers. I actually tried to write a sitcom with Rowan about him being a sort of incompetent detective. But just anything set in modern times just seems so poor in comparison to the genius of Fawlty Towers. What really happened with Blackadder is we tried to do something super new in that it was the first series, was filmic, didn't have a live audience, you know, was a bit of a mess. And the lesson I learned was there's something unbelievably great about traditional sitcom, which is almost like a play performed in front of a live audience, only takes 2 hours to make. So we got really lucky that we got that second one. And it was a strange fusion between our kind of historic grand ambitions, a sitcom with death and jeopardy and kings and queens, and then the kind of old reality of something like, you know, Dad's Army or The Good Life, which is just being done in front of an audience at a BBC studio.
The next series, though, a certain Ben Elton was recruited, and the show turned somewhat of a corner. When writing this show between you, what was the process of writing like?
Oh, Juno, it was such fun, and I remember it so clearly. Basically, Ben is very profligate. You know, he can write a show in a day. So the thing was, we just agreed on the period. We'd do it Elizabethan. And then basically, we both went off. It was in the days of floppy disks. We both went off. We worked for a week. I would start two shows. He would start and pretty well finish two shows. And then we'd meet at his house, mainly talk about Kylie Minogue and Madness, not talk about the show, swap the floppy disks, and then rewrite the other one's show. And we had this one absolutely key rule, which was that you were never allowed to put back in something that the other person had cut. And the theory was, if you tell someone a joke and they don't laugh, it's not going to help saying, no, you don't understand it. Let me tell it to you again. They're going to laugh even less. Mm. So it was a kind of very quick, profligate process whereby we would just hone the other one's episodes. until it got to a point where we handed it in to the producer and then eventually the cast, and then a whole, you know, new swathe of rewriting happened.
Setting this series in some of the most pivotal events in history, how important was it to maintain some historical accuracy?
Well, look, we couldn't have done less research. I mean, we literally had the Lady Bird book of British history. But Ben was very clever. Ben actually knew it all. So I kind of had, you know, race memory. I knew that Sir Walter Raleigh, you know, was around the same time as Queen Elizabeth, as it were. But Ben, particularly on the First World War, really knew his onions. So I think what happened is we were accurate within our memories. And then once in a while, Ben would say, that's not right. We really should do this. But we didn't research it. And we didn't take the history very seriously. We just took the history that pretty well any, you know, person aged 30 would know and hoped it was right.
So moving on then, 1985, as a response to Michael Burke's harrowing film of From Ethiopia, which became the inspiration for Live Aid, you created Comic Relief. What was it with the comedy world at that time that you thought you would be able to create the perfect platform to raise money?
Well, it was a journey, you know, because the first thing we did, look, I just thought I happened by a strange sort of almost coincidence to go out to Ethiopia at that time because a friend of mine was going and I said, I'll go with you. and then we just thought, you know, it's a huge community, the comedy community, let's do our bit because the music community had done so fantastically. But the strange thing was, you know, the first thing we did was a live show. The first thing we did was exactly what the Secret Policeman's Ball had done, you know, the old tradition. And then literally at the party in Lenny's flat after that show, me and Len were talking and said, this is so weird because, you know, I haven't done anything on stage for 5 years. And we just said, we're TV people. Why don't we do it on TV? And also, telethons by then had become, you know, they didn't have much content. You know, they tend to just be reading things and handing over checks and a few songs. So we thought, surely we could actually do the job we know how to do, which is make funny TV a bit, and then make that into a fundraising mechanism. So we started with the trad, and then we actually kind of did what we knew how to do. But it was a, God, if you ever look back on the first one, it was one of the most chaotic television shows of all time.
Just so he thinks he's seen the first ever one.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if he remembers, but Josh, in that first one, we actually showed a whole episode of The Young Ones and a whole episode, I think, of Dad's Army in the middle of the show. I mean, we really didn't know for half an hour without asking for money. We really had no idea what we were doing. And of course, it's much more sophisticated now.
Mm. Apart from raising over £1 billion for worldwide causes, Comic Relief has also been responsible for many hours of unforgettable television. Putting the charity aspect to one side just for a moment, how do you think Comic Relief has helped push the boundaries of light entertainment?
Well, that's funny that. I mean, I suppose the thing that I would say is that it was still very odd in those days for people who didn't belong together to be together. You know, as it were, the most famous example were the guest stars on Morecambe and Wise, but it wasn't done much. And I suppose the thing I think that, you know, our format, which is try and get someone to take the thing they do and then make it very special. So, you know, putting David Beckham together with Sacha Baron Cohen, as it were, you know, doing a special of Men Behaving Badly where Kylie Minogue turns up, or The Vicar of Dibley where Fergie or Johnny Depp turns up. You know, I think we rushed that thing of people from different worlds meeting, and so much kind of, you know, even Strictly Come Dancing, as it were, so much TV now. And almost all pop music is, you know, Kanye West feat somebody else. So I think we were, and we did the first celebrity reality show. Celebrity Big Brother was the first celebrity. I mean, people thought it was so shocking at the time. And now celebrity reality is one of the biggest things in the world. So I think our effect, rather than on sort of the texture of proper comedy, was on the infusion of other worlds and the kind of mix and match of the whole world of popular culture. And I think we were a part of accelerating that, I'd say.
So, do you remember when they sent the football team to Africa?
Yeah, well, that was, again, sort of reality celebrity TV, wasn't it? And by the way, I've just written down here, Cliff and the Young Ones, the first thing we ever did was that single, Living Doll, with the Young Ones and Cliff, who they'd always talked about in their show, but they actually were in the same room doing the same thing together. So I think that thing of putting famous people either in odd situations like the football thing or together like Cliff and the Young Ones is probably our kind of most radical thing that we did most often.
Mm. 7 hours of live television is no mean feat. And over the years, Comic Relief has made a conscious effort to stay on the cutting edge of live entertainment, reflecting the ever-changing fads in comedy. But in your opinion, how vital have people like Sir Lenny Henry and Jonathan Ross been in giving the show a vital backbone to which to develop and grow?
Yeah, I think that is that is the shape of it. Because, you know, you've got, and now increasingly it's a relatively kind of older audience. And the thing was, make people feel safe, friendly, welcomed. And then, you know, I think when we had Sasha on the show, that was the first time he'd been off Channel 4. You know, Ricky, I think The Office was still on BBC Two the first time he appeared on BBC One. So I think that mixture, you're absolutely right, Josh, that mixture of saying if we have very, you know, safe people who people know and love, then in a show like ours, which is very miscellaneous, you can throw in some curveballs and introduce people to new people.
In your opinion, how significant was TV Centre in providing a stable home for Comic Relief for 28 years?
Oh, well, look, it was lovely, you know. You know, the 7 hour show really is, no matter how much work you do in advance, it is chaos. You know, just because the length of items changes, you don't know how long the hosts are going to do things for. There are so many things that come in late. So the fact that we were there in TV Centre in a lovely studio, but that we were 100 yards from our office, which was like on the fourth floor, and 100 yards from the edits that were in another wing, meant that in that last unbelievably chaotic 72 hours, we were all within running distance of each other. I mean, it would have been really hard to do it, particularly in the early years, if you'd been at some, you know, if you'd been at some separate place where you had to get in a cab and drive.
Moving on now to something slightly different. The Church of England first allowed the ordination of women to priesthood in 1992, with ordinations were commencing in 1994. Sitcoms had always attempted to echo and celebrate the changes in our society, but with the exception of The Good Life, it had never given quite an instant response to substantial social landmarks. How do you think The Vicar of Dibley helped to ease the controversy of female vicars and humanise the church as a whole?
Well, I don't know. That's a lovely, you know, question. And I think it was a lucky moment. For some reason or other, I went to a sort of non-church wedding of a friend of mine. So it was in whatever it is, you know, a council chamber or something. And the person who was invigilating was a woman. And it was like, I had an absolute flash. I thought, this is the right person to be doing it. I said, you know, my mum's the one who's always paid attention to my girlfriends and how I'm feeling much more than my dad. How odd it is that it's men who keep their emotional distance who've been doing these weddings all the time. It should be the women, you know, though at least that felt much better to me. Yeah. So I came away with a bee in my bonnet. And the lucky thing for me was I'd also was living in a really sweet little country village. So I kind of been thinking about writing a sitcom about a village. And so I dove in and we did do it fast. And it was a moment of change. And there was this great female vicar called Joy Carroll, really great religious name, carols that bring joy. And I've been told by a lot of people, I mean, I sat next to a bishop the other day at Mansion House at some meeting about finance in the city. And I've always been told it was quite helpful. You know, whatever that phrase is, you can't be what you can't see. It was so obvious that female vicars were a great idea, so weird that they weren't there, that I think it was a useful, thing. And I think I'm hoping it did smooth the transition. And that's the story I do get back from a lot of people in the church I meet.
1994, you wrote a film which would, unbeknownst to everyone, define a generation and put British film back on the international map. Before Four Weddings and a Funeral, what do you think it was about the image of British movie which was misrepresented and associated with dated and wobbly sets in Pinewood?
I mean, I don't know that that's... I don't think I can sit by while that, you know, because I was inspired by Gregory's Girl, you know. I love that movie. My favourite movie of all time is Brief Encounter. There was a great movie called Rita, Sue and Bob 2. So I think there have been good films, hundreds of them, and better films than Four Weddings. I think just somehow, in some ways, I almost think it was the sort of packaging and the way that we went about it. I was really interested in marketing. And once we got a sniff that this was a funny movie and quite a glamorous movie, which often they hadn't been before, there was a little bit more of a kind of kitchen sink feeling to the modern films, you know. And I think in some ways they've been the historical films, and then the films that were modern tend to be grittier, grainier, you know, Ken Loach, those kind of films. So I think we happened to make a quite shiny modern movie, and then we marketed the hell out of it. We were unbelievably lucky that Hugh Grant was a movie star. You know, we had a hit song that was number one for 14 weeks. You know, so it was a lot to do with the marketing. But maybe the answer is that it was that what a lot of people hadn't done was made modern films that were a bit kind of shinier and more sort of format driven. Because this was a rom-com, even though I must admit, I didn't think of it as a rom-com when I was writing it.
Yeah. We're just going to hop back now. 1990, you created what was considered a very original television vehicle for Rowan Atkinson. With lashings of slapstick and very sparse dialogue, how easy was it for you to pitch your concepts for Mr. Bean to unsuspecting TV management?
Well, you know, we were really lucky then. So much is to do with luck. So the original Mr. Bean episode was, in fact, three sketches that we'd done on stage, actually with three different characters. You know, we didn't think of them as one bloke. But what happened was an executive, I think it was John Howard Davis at ITV, said, Rowan, do you want to do a special? We didn't have anything up our sleeves, except we thought this character. So we made the same character and the same thing. So in fact, it was a lucky pilot. You know, it wasn't that we went to them. It was oddly that they came to us. And then the question was, could you stretch it out? And that was, I mean, I think the admirable thing is that, you know, it had taken us 10 years to come up with those three sketches. And then we had to come up with, you know, 30 in the next 5 years. But, you know, we always had fun in the room, and Rowan got other people on board, particularly a guy called Robin, to help. So it was kind of friendship, luck, and having, you know, Rowan's genius. But his catchphrase for that show was always, will they get it in Egypt? So even like if there was a sign on a door and it said, you know, enter here, Rowan would insist that there was a graphic that showed it was a door with an arrow, just so that the show would always, you know, that anyone in the world could understand it.
Mm-hmm. It's well known that the subject of Christmas automatically makes a project have some longevity. In 2003, you created the formidable Love Actually. How do you think you put your own stamp on the Christmas movie?
Well, it's quite funny. I discovered my original notes for Love Actually quite recently. And the name of the file is Shortcuts Movie. So I was thinking about Shortcuts and Nashville and Smoke, you know, movies with lots of plots. And like 5 pages down in the notes, it actually says, wait a minute, this is the best idea ever. We could set it at Christmas. So I had this idea of lots of plots, but it suddenly occurred to me, if you set it at Christmas, there's a kind of deadline. People often think, oh, I've got to tell that girl I love her before Christmas. Oh, I've got to buy that present before Christmas. Oh, I'm taking a holiday at Christmas. I better get this thing done. So it was just immensely convenient to me. And I don't think, you know, no one's bigger than Christmas. So all I did was, I think, exploit Christmas for all its wonderful things of music, love, you know, nativity plays and stuff like that.
Mm. The Beatles and philosophical determinism are two concepts that you rarely hear in the same sentence. But what made you think that they were a perfect combination to base a film on, which resulted in the 2019 romantic comedy Yesterday?
I don't even know what philosophical determinism is. You'll have to explain it to me.
So the opposite of free will.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Look, actually, the strange thing about the Yesterday movie is that I didn't have the original idea. Someone came to me and said, there's this idea, will you write it up? So I can't take credit for having linked together the Beatles and philosophical determinism, I have to admit.
just a happy coincidence.
Yeah.
If you knew what it was, if anyone knew what it was. Looking back at your career, what's your proudest achievement?
It's definitely got to be Comic Relief. It's one of those examples where you act as a kind of trigger for something. You know, I was a very minor figure, even in the comedy community when it started. But when I opened the door, in charged, you know, all the big guns. And, you know, I'm very proud of the money that's made. And I think it was very helpful kind of opening people up, particularly to problems and lives abroad, by making them, you know, accessible, particularly through the eyes of people you know, knew and trusted, without having to be very serious or detailed. So I think Comic Relief is the one. I mean, if I had to pick any others, I'm glad I was around to work with Rowan, because I think he's a genius. I'm very sorry about having helped Hugh Grant to celebrity and unhappiness. But I think Comic Relief, and then, you know, I love the fact that the movies have turned out to be a kind of comfort thing. You know, it's that they're watched a lot and they make people happy, because, you know, you can't, the future is always uncertain. And if you can provide a bit of joy while we're going through life, then, you know, hooray.
Yeah. What's next for Richard Curtis?
I mean, I'm hoping I'm going to dedicate myself to philosophical determinism and and a study of it. I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to wind down a little bit. I'm working on something new, and I'm actually working on one, if not two, animations, which I'm really enjoying. They're so interesting because you write, edit, cast, and sort of direct. I'm not directing, you know, at the same time. I'm looking at doing maybe something in the theatre. I just quite like the idea of going back where Rowan and I started and, you know, being with actors and stuff. But on the whole, I'm hoping to wind down a bit, read more books, you know, grow more vegetables.
Just said, do you think you'd ever go back to writing another TV sitcom series, or do you think that's something which is done as like a passing thing for a writer on their way up or through, I suppose?
Well, that's a good question. The truth is, Josh, I did a few years ago have an idea for a new sitcom, and I love sitcoms. And, you know, the strange thing in a way about my career was that while I was writing Notting Hill, I was writing The Vicar of Dibley. You know, I never thought that one form was better than the other. But, you know, sitcoms are a lot of work. It's great if you can do two or three series. And I just don't want to go through that massive complexity. But I'll tell you the idea I had, which was something called Greatest Living Writer, and it was going to be about a man who's the greatest living writer but a horrible man. And the idea was that he lives with his family, something complicated happens in the morning, he always gets drunk at lunch, and because he's slightly drunk, it goes disastrously wrong in the afternoon. And I had a lot of ideas for that, but I think it's going to have to just stay on my computer. It's going to have to just be a dream.
I didn't think you'd ever met Josh before.
Yeah. Is that him? Yeah. You're drunk at lunchtime.
Drunk by lunch. Sounds a bit like Shakespeare.
Well, I think that's libel.
Yeah.
But we don't know. Yeah. But I love sitcom. I think it's one of the great formats. I watched an amazing show the other day called Big Boys. Have you seen that?
No. Seen it advertised, yeah.
Yeah, no, you should definitely watch it and stick with it. It's by this guy called Jack Rook. It's brilliant. My son made me watch an episode of Derry Girls that I'd only seen a couple of just last night. It was brilliant. I think sitcom's an amazing, joy-bringing format. If I was sure I was going to live to 120, I would definitely try and write two more.
Well, that's all the questions we've got. So thank you very much for your time.
Not at all. It's a real pleasure, and I love the, you know, how interested and knowledgeable you are about these subjects. Because one of the strange things about being a writer, and particularly a writer in comedy, is people don't think very seriously about it. And maybe that's a good thing, but it's lovely to be asked, you know, intelligent and passionate questions.
Oh, yeah, love.
Trust me, he loves talking about comedy. So,
thank you to our guest for being the subject of another Beyond the Title interview. If you liked this, why not browse the website and see if there's anything else that takes your fancy? Don't forget to like our Facebook page to receive updates on forthcoming interviews and to see more information about me and what I do. Thanks again, and hopefully see you next time.